just so that I can make sure that our levels are good, could you just go ahead and tell me your name and how you're affiliated with the cemetery real quick?
Okay. My name is Darrell Carmichael, and in 1993, I owned and operated Carmichael Toll and Recovery in Richmond, and the county commissioners contacted my company and asked us if we could help with the recovery of the cemetery after the flood. So that's how I got into that.
That's how you got involved with that big mess in Hardin, huh?
Yes, yes.
Now, it's coming up, we just discussed it, but it is coming up 20 years for that terrible flood that washed all those coffins away.
Yeah, that was approximately July 10th when the levee broke of 93. And the levee there at the cemetery was a secondary levee, not the one that holds the water back from the river. It had already broken. But there was approximately 5 miles of water backed up across the Missouri River bottoms. And when the levee broke there at the cemetery in Hardin, that turned all that water through the cemetery. And then the water coming over the levee there into the cemetery created a boil, and that action of the water churning eroded away the soil and created a hole about 60 feet deep and 500 feet across, and that was right in the heart of the cemetery. And as it eroded away the soil and got to the grave sites, it just started uprooting them and taking the vaults and caskets and everything with the flood water.
And about how many did you end up recovering?
Actually, there was, I believe, 783 graves disturbed. And there was well as a total of 1,479 graves in the cemetery. So it actually disrupted approximately half of the burial sites. Now, you have to bear in mind that that cemetery dates back to the early 1800s, so therefore not all of the grave sites were in concrete vaults or even in caskets as we know them. A lot of them were buried in wooden caskets, and so there was virtually nothing left there of the remains that were washed out.
That you guys could even save.
Yeah, but the burials, you know, of late, and I say of late, I mean in the last, 75 years or close to 100, has been in vaults and caskets, so those were recoverable. And downstream from the cemetery, the area affected took in about 64,000 acres, where the vaults and caskets were spewing, and it just deposited the floodwaters, washed them out, and as they went downstream, it deposited them in cornfields and fence rows and tree lines and drainage ditches. We found a lot of them washed up on high ridges in the bottoms. Of course, the bottoms being flat, you don't have a lot of places to catch anything, but... And then there was a lot of mud and silt that was covering everything. And some of these vaults and caskets were almost completely reburied by the floodwaters. And not just the water, but the mud and silt that flowed with the waters.
Now, how long did it take you guys to do that, to recover all that?
Actually, we started in July, right after they noticed that there was damage, and we completed it in November. So we were several months at it, and right through the hottest part of the summer. And it was warm in 93.
Yeah.
Very warm.
Yes, it was. Didn't help those floodwaters at all.
But, yeah, we had quite a time getting our equipment to function, because when we first went in there, we had to take gravel loads. Highway 10 was closed due to it being washed away, an area there about 40-foot deep and 200-feet long strip. So you couldn't use Highway 10, and we had to go around and come in the gravel roads, and had to traverse water over the roadway there that was over waist deep. And so we had to special rig our trucks so that we could manage to get through that water, right? Sealing things up and sealing the fuel tanks and extending the exhaust and whatnot. You know, it's just logistical things that have to happen before we could even get in there. And but then we did, and tried to start working from the cemetery out, and we found that the best way to get out into the fields there by the cemetery was to take a winch off a truck and drag the cable out manually by hand. We'd have had a lot of people from the Missouri Funeral Directors Association helping, and so we had lots of warm bodies, and we would just take the cable and manually pull it out, and you couldn't walk through this mud and muck. It was, you'd just sink in way over your knees if you tried to stand in it. So we found that it worked best to crawl on your stomach and drag this cable. And we would drag cable up to 1,500 feet away from the highway and retrieve those caskets and vaults. And they were heavy. I mean, they're, the average weight of a vault being concrete is anywhere from 800 pounds to 1,000. And, of course, everything was waterlogged and full of mud and everything, so that adds to the weight and the sand, and so it's not something that you can just manhandle. You have to have machinery, and we did that and got a lot of them retrieved. Then, as we had to move farther into the fields and everything, we used a caterpillar with extra wide pads on it so that it could maneuver in the mud. And they actually call it a mud cat. They use a lot of those down in the swamps of Louisiana. And so, anyway, we got a mud cat in there and put a boom on the side of it where we could pick the vaults. And we got a lot of them out that way. And anyway, it was quite a process. And on our equipment, we have heavy equipment, but not set up to do anything like that. And so it took a while for us to get acclimated as to what we were doing, you know, and how to do it. A burial vault is concrete, has a concrete walls and a concrete bottom, and then the lid lifts off. But even though it's concrete and it's heavy, it's still very fragile, and you can't put a lot of pressure on it, you know, when you pick it up. So it has to be rigged in a certain manner to keep from destroying it. And we had to learn that and learn how to rig it and what, you know, what fashion of rigging worked and what didn't. And then we had to equip our trucks so that we could load and unload off of the truck. You can't just set concrete down and then pick it up again. You have to have something under it. And anyway, it was a learning experience on our part.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you guys have never done anything like this before. I'd never even heard of anything like that happening before.
So, it was quite a feat. And but the longer we stayed with it, the better we adapted. And by the end of it, and by the way, this is the largest cemetery disaster in the United States to history. And so anyway, the government realized that this was a possibility of reoccurring, not Beth Hardin, but other places in the United States. And so they created a task force to respond to emergencies and catastrophes like that. And they asked my son and I if we would be interested in helping them with that. And so we both joined that task force, and I've been with them since 93. And I still do that all over the United States and even the world. We travel worldwide.
To do the same thing that you did in Hardin?
Well, yeah, basically, and I've evolved from that. I'm logistics chief for 4 states now with the NDMS, National Disaster Medical Service.
Okay.
And, but we do respond to all types of emergencies. We've gone to Hurricane Katrina, worked at. I've worked 8 different hurricanes across the southern states, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida. And we respond to air crashes. We work the Twin Towers. And anytime there's mass fatalities, why is it we're called in? And so it's been quite an interesting thing that came up from working at the cemetery.
So you guys have gone from knowing nothing to recovering coffins to, or to even working a catastrophe to being on the top of the chain right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's been quite a learning experience. And it's been quite a ride, too, I'll tell you for sure, in the last 20 years.
Now, is any of your family buried in the Hardin Cemetery?
No.
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 So it wasn't like a personal connection. It was just that the city had asked you to do it.
Well, except being local here, I know a lot of people that have loved ones buried there.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, it was very personal. Very personal for me. Because when you recognize a name and you realize that that's someone you know's brother, sister, cousin, it becomes very personal. And you just have to overcome that, a lot of people couldn't understand how that we could just go and do that. And I told them, somebody's going to do it, and you're making a bad situation better. And that's the way you have to look at it. And it's a job, and you do it. So that's how we get by it.
That's right. And not only that, but these communities around here are so tight-knit. Like you said,
mm-hmm.
You do know somebody, and even if your family's not directly affected, your friends are, and it's,
yes.
With it being so tight-knit, it's pretty rough.
Yeah, it does. It does come back home. So, but anyway, I think that all in all, the recovery went really well. After the initial cleanup, we had a few stragglers, that we found later on. But by and large, I believe we have recovered all of the remains that we can out there. And as many of them as possible were identified and put back in separate graves, and some of them even in other cemeteries.
Now, I've drove by, and I've noticed ever since I was a kid that those, there's that big hole there, which is that where it took out, is right there in the middle, that big hole right there in the middle?
Exactly. Where you see the water standing now, once was level across, and that's where the water came over the levee and cut that out of there.
And there's like a cluster of headstones. Is that some of the ones that were transferred?
Yes. Those are headstones that were taken out of that water area and placed over there just in a group.
Are those people that you guys couldn't like ones that you couldn't identify, but you
exactly.
still moved the...
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know at that time. I didn't know anything about forensics, and that wasn't my area of expertise whatsoever. But since then, we've done a lot of work in forensics, and it's just awfully, awfully hard when you don't have any information on a person. I mean, you're looking at a burial 100 years old. They had no dental records, and of course, fingerprints aren't viable.
Right.
That type of thing. So your forensics are very, very limited. And when you reach back, I mean, if you're dealing with forensics today in today's science, why, with DNA and everything, you can almost identify anyone.
Right.
But to reach back 100 years ago, awfully hard. And so that's why that there was a lot of unidentified. But they were handled in a positive way and put into a separate burial site there at the cemetery. And we created a plat for that area. And if at any time there's in the future there would be an identification or any way to identify, we can go back and exhume those because we know just exactly where they're located. I mean, each one is within a quarter inch north, south, east, west where it should be. And so that was very uplifting to me to know that they're there. They're all returned back and in an orderly fashion.
Absolutely. Well, Daryl, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? I'm going to get this over to Sarah. And
okay. I don't really think so. I just, it's good to look back 20 years later and not have to worry about that much work ever again, we hope.
We hope.
And but to know that it can be done, and we were thankful to be a part of it.
Well, we appreciate all the hard work that you did, and I'm sure it was, like you said, it was torrential. So, but I will... I appreciate, again, you taking the time to talk to me, and I will I'll get this taken care of.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right,
Daryl.
Well, thank you.